Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity. My name is Matthew Lee Anderson. I'm your host for the show. We have the whole cast and crew with us today. We also have our very super special guest, Andrew Wilson. Delighted to have Andrew back on the show. It's been a long time. Stick around, Patreon listeners, for a plus one, which we're going to do with the one and only Andrew Wilson. So you can get that if you join the merry band of Patreon supporters. So we have some news. I'm super delighted to say that this is the first show that is sponsored by our new partners at Lexham Press. Lexham Press, we've been dating them for a while. We love the sort of things that they're up to. We've had a number of their guests on. Most prominently, we've had a Harold Sinkbill on twice. I think I just said his name wrong, for which I apologize. But, you know, the two shows that we've had with him on Christ in Calamity and The Office of the Pastor, he just has so much wisdom. Just a fount of wisdom and knowledge from his years of experience. And Lexham Press has brought him to the world of Christian thought, for which, well, at least brought our evangelical thought, for which we're very grateful. And so we're delighted to have Lexham be a sponsor of the show. You're going to hear this, you know, listeners, you're going to hear Lexham ads every now and then, but we're never going to advertise something that we're not fully committed to ourselves personally. Also, it doesn't invalidate, and like my thought is that this is going to actually increase the interest in becoming Patreon supporters. None of us are making any money from this. The Patreon supporters are not going away from this. We're still, I think, going to do even more for our Patreon supporters than we've ever done before, including, I will say, our next live show just for Patreon supporters, which is coming October 7th. So if you're interested in doing a live show where it's Q&A with, we'll have three of us, our special guest, Andrew Wilson, won't be on it.
Perhaps, if you're interested,
perhaps Derek's cat will make an appearance, but we are going to do a live show October 7th. So if you want to join that, do become a Patreon supporter. Thanks to Lexham Press, lexhampress.com. Check them out. We're grateful for their support. All right, so let's dive into it, guys. We've talked some in recent weeks about scandal, and we talked some in the midst of that about some of the dangers of adopting the mode or the mantle of the prophet within one's own community. Today, we thought we'd expand the horizon a little bit to think just about speech and communications more broadly, and how to undertake the vocation of Christian witness in what we communicate, both in our communities and more broadly. So we thought that we'd take this up. Alistair, you have raised this as an issue, so I'm going to throw it to you. Set this up for us. What's here that we should think about?
Yes, I think it is a particular concern. The task of wisely speaking within the current context, where we have a more general, universal sort of medium, like the internet, social media, and we're speaking from a particular location. And there's always this danger of be taking on the mantle of the prophet at large or the pastor at large. And so you see the big problems of the world and the urges to speak to those problems in this very general way that does not recognize, first of all, your audience, where you're standing from the point from which you're speaking, what ethos you have to speak to particular issues, and the responsibilities that particularly lay upon your shoulders relative to your audience. How are you guiding them? And so to actually determine your audience and the way that you should speak is a challenge to us to a degree that it never has been in the past. Even people who are writing books would have a bit more of a sense of the character of their readership in the past. Now that's not so clear. And so the question is, how do we approach this? How do we avoid the danger of constantly speaking, for instance, to other people's sins and building up our own constituencies in self-righteousness? How do we avoid the danger of not actually speaking to the issues within our own communities and ending up in a situation where, or maybe trying to curry favor with a certain group of people? How do we consider the location of our voices and our duties and responsibilities in speech?
This is a hard problem that I think has actually affected us here on the show. Internally and privately, we've had a number of when we've had arguments about what we should say and not say, they have often divided along the lines of disagreements over our constituency and disagreements over what's happening in American evangelicalism versus British evangelicalism, and different senses or observations about even what the needs of the moment might be in light of those respective contexts and the differences between those respective contexts. So in terms of the practical problem, I think this is something that we wrestle with on an ongoing basis. Andrew, you're a pastor. When you're not podcasting with us, you actually are employed communicating the gospel to
flabbergasting thought though it may be, yes.
Which you are very employed because you're rarely podcasting with us. When you think about your vocation and how your vocation as a pastor intersects with your writing more broadly, how have you balanced those two concerns? How do you understand who your constituency is for your various communicative efforts?
Yeah, I think in some ways being a pastor makes it easier because your constituency is in large part defined by the people in your church. So the issues. So I moved church. Good example. I moved church 4 years ago. I knew I was going to move about 5 years ago from a very, in American terms, you know, middle-class suburban white town to a very black area in our capital city. And almost immediately, the kinds of things about which you find yourself writing and speaking, not just in the local church, but broader, change. You have to learn about them, and you spend some time, you know, reading before you start to speak, hopefully. Not always as long as I should, I'm sure, but generally you try and do that. But quickly, it's not just that the... It's not just that your constituency has changed, it's that your interest in serving them has changed and has redirected you from one field of inquiry to another because the questions you were asking about before just didn't come up and new questions become much more pressing. And so if someone was to track through my blog over the last 10 years, you would and knew that I'd moved church at some point in that 10 years, they would be able to tell when it was I moved to within a month or two, I expect, because you would see the kind of issues you're engaging with change. And I think that's in some ways built in, and that would affect, in a very obvious way, would affect Derek's role and my role in a way that it probably doesn't. Alistair's probably the other end of the spectrum, is, you know, when I say prophet at large, which I must admit, as obviously the only out and out charismatic on this show, I'm loving the idea that that's how Alistair is now choosing to self-identify. But I think it actually, but genuinely, I'd love to hear Alistair talk a bit more about the, I know you framed the problem well, but I'd love to hear you talk about the answer because I think your discernment, Alistair, and yours, Matt, I think, must be much more difficult to figure out. Like for me, it's quite easy. If someone in my church is asking this question, or I think they are swimming in waters that are colored by it, and it would help them pastorally for me to speak on it, then that's what I want to do, which is why I posted a big, long article on privilege and oppression and intersectionality this morning. Because I feel like I know this is a big issue for many people in my church, and I wanted to say this is, and I'm not, it's not a pastoral letter or anything, but it's just, this is my take on it. Whereas there are many, many issues that people email me or tweet me and say, we'd love to hear your voice on X. And you just go, no, because no one in my church is asking that question. That's not a fruitful use of my time. But I think it's much more difficult when you are the prophet at large. And I'm, by the way, I hope at the end of this, we now no longer refer to him as Fancy Dr. Roberts or anything like that, but simply refer to him as PAL Alistair.
Al
is our pal. There we go.
Palister. That's what we should call him. It's brilliant. Prophet at large. Yes, it all works.
We haven't heard that expression in
years.
So thank you for reviving something from the past that should have never existed anyway.
Past never dies, man. Past never dies.
I will say, if Alistair's Twitter bio by the end of the day doesn't say prophet at large, something will have gone wrong. So Alistair, it's on you, man. Only you can make this right.
I've been quite uncomfortable with the idea of thinking of myself as a prophet at large. I think that is a dangerous role to assume. So I've tended to try and retreat to a context where I have a clearer sense of my audience and can have a regular interaction with them, can have a sense of who is within it and who is not. And the danger I've always found is that of speaking to a group of people that you'll have a lot of supporters that will be cheering you on because you're speaking to a certain set of sins that they see very clearly because they are the mote in their opponent's eyes. And yet you're not actually addressing the concerns of your own particular constituency. And when you're a more general speaker on the internet, that is something that is incredibly hard to avoid, because we all see very clearly through these constant frustrating interactions with people who disagree with us, these issues that just seem so pronounced. And people within our camp, as soon as they try and deal with them, they'll often say, well, this is really an issue, but we need to remember that there's this issue in our own particular constituency. We have to recognize issues on both sides. And that is precisely in order, I think, to avoid that instinct of self-righteousness where you're always addressing the sin of some other party and not actually acquainting yourself with your own. And the challenge of actually discerning what is your own, for instance, is my context that defined by groups of friends that come from a more academic context, or is it the more the context of people who are studying the Bible within the context of their local churches? Is it my local context here, which is a more working class sort of background location? Is it the UK? Is it the fact that I'm going to the US in, on many occasions? I'm kind of caught between contexts, and it can be very convenient to choose the context that is most convenient to me at the time for my voice. But I've found it's almost important to create a context so that you're not just speaking across contexts where people will hear you in so many different ways and take your words in ways that are simply unhelpful, because there's no discipline upon what you mean provided by that context. And so people will take your words out of any sort of frame of context and apply them within their own worlds where they're used very unhelpfully.
I'm just laughing because it is, I certainly feel all the temptations that Alistair feels to align my words with my constituency. But I also think I probably feel another set of temptations, maybe more strongly. I may or may not have deliberated at points in my life about how much I was going to anger people. And that became a reason to do something. Just to avoid the kinds of dangers of only preaching to people who really liked what I had to say. Like, you do have this sort of how often can I send a tweet that alienates some of my constituency, right? When I think that it's a responsible, reasonable thing to do. And, when I've given talks in various places, some in some very controversial contexts, you know, I've had to think to myself, like, how nervous do I feel about giving this talk and how these words will be received? And that sense of nervousness is to me indicative of that I think I'm doing something right, and that there is something that I need to say in that particular context, right? That there is some sort of challenge that I have to lay down. I'm just you hear these stories. I don't know if this is true, but growing up, I remember hearing a story of A.W. Tozer. I grew up in the Christian Missionary Alliance Church. Shout out to all the CMA people. And A.W. Tozer is, you know, sort of one of the most prominent Christian Missionary Alliance writers. And I remember hearing a story growing up about how he was once invited to open a massive new church in, I believe, Chicago. And it was just this beautiful church. The church had spent a lot of money on it. And so he came and gave the first sermon about luxury, and denounced the luxury that they had basically partaken in, and chastised the church for indulging in a kind of consumerist mentality and so on and so forth. He was, as you could imagine, never invited back. And that, like, I don't know if that story is true, but you kind of want that story to be true, right? You kind of want that guy who's going to say, like, look, I'm willing to not be invited back to tell these people a really hard thing that I think they need to hear at this particular juncture. And I think in terms of knowing how to speak with respect to your audience, the willingness to alienate them is, I think, a crucial discipline to undertake.
What limits would you put on that? Like, how would you tell? You guys both do this. You guys offend people. There was a time when I got you guys into more trouble than you got me. And
that long past
hasn't been true for long some years. I don't know why it was ever true in the first place. I think I got Alistair into a lot of trouble, but simply by linking to something he'd said and getting more than a handful of people to read it. And then Matt got me in a lot of trouble by posting something saying, I think the tweet, I still remember it, you said, Andrew Wilson has written the satire we need. And then about 12 hours later, just an explosion of the angriest people on the internet with rainbow flags came after me. But I don't know where, how, and you know, joking aside, how do you know when you are, well, what checks do you place on yourself to stop yourself from just wading into and speaking because you want to speak truth to power? You know your own heart, you know how difficult it is to read that well. In my case, I have a boss, I have a church, I have, you know, I probably not to the same degree as Derek, but there are systems and formal processes in that context of on whose behalf you speak and what kinds of things we think it's appropriate for you to say. How do you guys do that? I mean, taking the point about not wanting to be prophet at large, but it's a joke with a meaning, because there is, when you are not speaking on behalf of a church or an organization, it's much more difficult, presumably, to read your boundaries that way and know, am I sounding off about this because I just don't like them, or something, they've annoyed me, or is it because I actually think this is edifying? And so how do you do that, Alistair or Matt?
I find I pay a lot of attention to the people who are interacting with me the most, and then I'll try and... first of all, if you're going to follow the pattern that we see in Proverbs, the faithful are the wounds of the friend, you need to be a friend. You need to be someone who takes seriously their concerns, gives weight to what they're saying, recognizes the truth, etc., and then pushes back at key points and does so in a way that respects their voice, that listens to them, engages with them, and gives weight to their concerns, but is not going to just let them off. And also to be someone who is making friendships through that. So you will, what they call steel man, opposing positions, that you will put them in their strongest possible form so that people will have to reckon with the views of their neighbours that they might not otherwise engage with. And so I think that there is a sort of creative task there where you have to be able to enter a number of different mindsets and retain them or bring them into a healthy conversation. Because so much, I think, of our lives online are defined by these alienating, mutually misunderstanding discourses where people are just bumping into each other and becoming more and more hardened and polarized and digging in their heels. And the danger is that you end up just speaking for a particular, let's say, moderate position within that. You're pushing against one side and pushing against the other side. And then you start to develop your own moderate camp. And that has its own problems. So you always need to be aware of who are you surrounding yourself with and pay attention first and foremost to the sins that you see within yourself and speak to those in a way. Try and be attentive to those. It's always about following the biblical pattern, I think. If we're going to be people of good judgment, we have to start with the plank in our own eye, and we need to measure with the measure that we apply to ourselves. And so, first of all, apply these things to yourself. Be rigorous and don't let yourself off the hook. Listen to the strongest criticisms of your greatest opponents. And you don't necessarily need to amplify their voices. Often they will be very unhelpful voices. You don't want them to be broadcast or shared, but you need to take their force and to feel the weight and then to apply that, work that through, and then from that inner work to speak out. So for me, that involves just trying to focus on particular people in your audience that are you're most engaged with, speak to their particular issues, occasionally notice other people on the sidelines, speak to them. But having built friendship, you're not just someone who's going in trying to explode any situation you find yourself in. Ideally, you want to win this person over. And so having that foundation of friendship is important.
There's so much there that I agree with, especially the point about friendship. There's a talk that Stanley Hauerwas gave in the early 90s, I think, where he went into a gathering of gay people who were Christians, and he basically said no to what they were trying to do. And he has this line where he says, like, what authorizes me to tell you this? He says, well, I'm here as a friend. And that context of friendship, where you are accompanying these individuals in a way that allows you to say no with a kind of authority, because you're saying no, within that context, I think is really, really valuable. There are limits to that. Some of the contexts that I think I write in the States are perverse in some certain respects around requiring certain standards of friendship before critiques get made, or requiring certain types of interpersonal contact before people would make really forceful criticism. So it comes with some drawbacks to that mentality, but I think that's generally the right way to think about it. And Alistair's point about working through your own sins and following that biblical pattern is precisely right. From my standpoint, you know, it begins with evaluating the plank in your own eye, and then it turns to evaluating your own particular communities and taking seriously the fact that judgment begins at the house of God, and being honest about the form that judgment needs to take before you then expand it towards those who would either not be members of your communities, or you would be sort of saying they should not be members of our communities, right? Where you'd be arguing that someone should be outside. So I think like those sorts of disciplines are necessary for avoiding becoming a kind of prophet at large who's just constantly blowing things up.
Yeah. So this is one of those places where, I mean, the online context is, you know, so volatile, but it's also so it's real, but it's false. You know, you can present yourself one way online, very forceful, very bold, very all these things, and then in person be very meek. Paul, his letters are forceful, but in person, or vice versa. And I find for myself, I'm most comfortable being direct in the context of a sermon or in speech with one of my students or somebody in my church, because like, well, they have the whole context of my life. They know that I love them, presumably, that we're having like a conversation within the context of like, hey, we have this shared life, and so on and so forth. Or if it's like an evangelistic engagement, I'm trying to convince you to like repent and believe the gospel. And so I'll just more likely to throw it out there, versus a lot of online speech, I get actually far more cynical. I just want to call BS on a lot of online prophetic posturing that is just.
Derek, what haven't you told me? Are you gonna, you know, if this is the time to engage in fraternal correction towards me, no, I am open.
No, I'm just saying there's a certain amount of that where there's an interesting point where being prophetic online about like the church, well, there's also the multiple context collapse dimension where somebody's prophetic speech to and for and about the church is then also done in a public forum where it's picked up by the enemies of the church and used against it. So one of the easiest, I'll just use this, one of the easiest ways, especially when it comes to platform building, one of the easiest ways to get your name in a secular publication, to get your name in the Times, to get your name in whatever, is to play the role of the, hey, I am an evangelical. And from the inside, I can tell you, these people really are as nuts and as awful as you've always thought they were. And you just confirm the priors of the people who are reading these publications. There was just an awful piece, I'll name it, in Salon the other day by Mike Ray, who's just a noted, respected philosopher who, he kind of pulls this move. And it's one thing to speak directly like that to evangelical. I mean, if you have that conviction, which he has, if you speak that directly to evangelicals in their own contexts, that's one thing. If you say it about them behind their backs in a magazine that they don't read, that's another thing, right? And so I'm just uncomfortable with some of those kinds of playing prophet out there, which is where it's like, okay, absolutely, it's fine. Yeah. So, I mean, for me, I have big question marks right now, especially when the reward dynamic of playing prophet is so huge, because, you know, the prophets of Israel didn't get tons of retweets and likes and follows for railing on Israel and Judah and their home tribes, right? They couldn't, they got stones, they got, and it's true, people will play prophet online and they will get tons of hate, right? But they will also get tons, they can't, depending on how they play it, you can simultaneously get a lot of hate and a lot of approval, and you can play up the hate that you get in order to get more approval, and it becomes this feedback loop of platform building where, like, look at how much I'm suffering. And some people really, they honestly are standing by their convictions, they're speaking the truth, whatever. But some people, I kind of look at them like, you're playing a really smart game here. It's also a really dangerous one.
The iron rules that I have adopted are, one, never retweet insults or, you know, derogatory speech about me. Two, never talk about my email inbox, right? There's this move that people make like, oh, I've got these, you know, I'm hearing from all of these people who confirm my judgment about this or who are saying terrible things about me, et cetera, et cetera. None of that is verifiable, right? None of that can be authenticated. And it is the sort of posturing that people do to magnify their own position as martyrs for speaking the truth in ways that no one can test. And so I think one of the limits that I put in place for this sort of thing is only interacting with those who are in public and only responding to matters of public record or public controversy. Yeah, it seems to me, I mean, one of the things that we desperately need to retrieve is the category of scandal within the grammar of Christian speech, right? How are we engaging in speech in ways that scandalizes other believers, potentially by inclining them towards uncharity for those who are in the church, or a lack of charity towards those who are outside of the church, right? To scandalize someone is to create an occasion for them to sin, to have a less charity than they had before. And so much of the speech in public that is denunciatory or critical, a lot of it risks engaging in scandal, in driving people towards a kind of cynicism and a hardness of heart towards their own communities in ways that would be really problematic. So I, you know, reflecting on what scandal is and how we can understand it, I think would be a good thing for many Christian leaders to do.
So, okay, I don't know quite what you mean. Come out from behind the curtain, Matt. I never normally have to tell you this. You live your life in front of the curtain. But what do you mean? Help me. Why do I need to retrieve the category of scandal? Well, and what
let me try and speak for Matt just very briefly. I mean, so there's the level of like, there's the person who's always, you know, every story about a pastor failing or being awful or terrible, you share it to show that you know how awful the church is too. And it's like, you may, and I know it, I've been in the church and whatever, and you care about that issue, but you also, there's a way of doing that that like just completely reinforces somebody who's maybe in a delicate place spiritually with their church, or maybe is thinking they are in a delicate place spiritually with their church. And you just keep hammering all those stories and all these, you know, showing up the church's scandals and then scandalizing them and pushing them away. Now, this isn't a call for like secrecy. This isn't a call for dishonesty about the failures of different churches. It is a call for discretion and like, you know, having something of the Pauline instinct in 1 Corinthians 6 of like lawsuits before unbelievers. Now there are cases where you have to go to the public authorities when there's criminal offenses, things like that. Like there's abuse, you go to the authorities, all that sort of thing. And yet there's those other times where you're like, does the world need to see this dirt? Does this person need to see the dirt's real? We have to deal with it. We can't sweep it under the rug. So those are the two corresponding, I think, dangers. Some people just sweep things under the rug. They cover it over. They act like nothing's there. Other people are like, look at this dirt. And there's people across the street have no idea. They're just living their lives. They're like, come over here. Look at how terrible this is. Right. And it scandalizes them to the point where it damages their faith in certain ways. And so that's, I think, part of what's the dynamic of not being like a cover upper and at the same time not making your name off of like constantly drawing attention to how terrible the church is, which is, I think, different than what the prophets were doing, even though there are structural similarities in the way they did draw attention to the unfaithfulness of the people of God. So I think,
I approve that message.
There we go.
A couple of things that Derek brought up in his earlier comments that I think might be worth expanding upon. First of all, the prophet is not loved in his hometown, I think, in large part because the hometown expects you to be loyal to it. You have to, the hometown has all these different opponents and critics, and you need to stand up for it. And if you're not actually singing the praises of it, if you're actually criticizing it sharply, then you're seen as a traitor in whatever conflict is going on. And so people who are actually criticizing their friends, who are maybe saying things that might offend or hurt people in their own constituency, they're seen as disloyal. And particularly in a context where there is such a pronounced sense of being in a culture war, in being in political fights, where it really matters that we win. When people are disloyal, when they criticize their own side, that is a serious sin in many people's eyes. Loyalty must take priority over everything else. The other thing is Derek's remark about context collapse. One of the features of wisdom is knowing the season and the way to deliver words. It's an apple in setting of silver. It's knowing that what words need to be said, whether you are the person that needs to say it, to whom you should be saying it, when you should be saying it, etc. And often things that need to be said don't need to be said by you. And you would actually make things worse if you said them in a particular way, in a particular time, in a particular context. And it's recognizing that we do things with our words. So for instance, the person who gives the prophetic denunciation about evangelicalism in the context of some secular journal, they're doing something with those words that is not helpful. It's not actually bringing people to repentance. It's actually increasing the scandal of the people of God and that they would blaspheme the name of the Lord. It's something that's causing others to sin. It's exalting scandal. And then there are also times when people complain, you're not speaking strongly enough about this sin. When maybe you're let's say we're talking about the debates about homosexuality. It's one thing to think about that debate in the context of framing doctrine of the church and the danger of compromise. It's another context when you're actually speaking to someone who's thinking through and struggling through these issues personally, or maybe with a child in their family. And many people, as with the phenomenon of context collapse. They're hearing the words in one context that are wisely directed to another context. But with the collapse of those, it's almost impossible to speak with wisdom because the very medium militates against it.
I've written that that latter phenomenon is the hardest phenomenon, I think. And I've with respect to public speech, I mean, what we've had in the States is, to pick a different moral issue, controversies around abortion and infanticide. And we had a controversy last year where a governor said things that sounded like he was endorsing infanticide. And the objections to those that happened in public were reasonable in many ways, but what I was concerned about was they actually create a kind of deliberative context in cases that those questions would arise in that is actually harmful for the people who have to make those sort of decisions. And that kind of gap. I remember I once talked to someone who worked inside of a crisis pregnancy center who said that they don't actually refer to the fetus as a baby when they're counseling a woman. They'll use fetus. They'll use clinical sounding language to try to de-emotionalize the moment for them, to decrease the woman's fear so that they can make an appropriate, honest, truthful judgment about what's going to happen, because they are often so afraid. And that gap between what happens in, you know, the moment of pastoral care and the kinds of rhetoric that happen in public is, you're right, it's impossible to avoid.
Can I ask one last thing, maybe? This is something that occurs to me. I know we haven't got long, but the four of us would probably, I think, I'm not had anything I disagree with in this whole conversation, as far as I know. Whew. But the four of us sit at very different places on the spectrum when it comes to how much of our time and with what, I was going to say ferocity, that sounds like that's a negative word. I want a more neutral
intensity
word, the directness or ebullience or intense, with which we speak to what you might say our own tribe. Like, I'm basically trying to work out how far are the differences between Matt and me, or between Alistair and Derek, based on a personality, gift, calling, and office? How much are they based on, you know, do you think, for instance, Matt, that some of it's just based on there's a Christian obligation that you step into when you speak with the moral clarity you do to people from our tribe, that you think, I just wish other guys would step in there and do it a bit more because I think they're wussing out? Or do you feel more, I think I have an obligation to do this because partly where I've been placed on my history, gifts, background, or whatever, but I wouldn't extend that same expectation to me or Derek, or as in, I think I'm quite likable. I'm probably, you know, there's plenty of people throwing things at their podcast devices, but when I'm not, it's with people who I know I was always going to offend whenever I started talking about Christian orthodoxy. But you, Matt, have been, I think, pretty courageous, pretty bold in addressing the failings of, quote, our side, much more than I do. And I'm interested as to what extent you think, is that an issue of moral obligation? Is that an issue of, or do you read that through the lens of your own story, gift, calling, role, I don't know, personality even? So, I would be interested to know that. And Alistair, you could chip in if you
Matt,
because you're,
are you,
also, you do it differently.
Matt, are you constitutionally annoying, or is this a gift of the spirit?
There's always going to be a way of making that sound like a snarky question.
And I'm going to take it.
You know how much I love you, and I genuinely want to know. Like,
I'm going to let Alistair go first. I do like to think of myself as likable, though. That's the only thing as well. So, you know, I think I'm mildly likable.
Self-knowledge, man. Self-knowledge.
I find, for me, the big issue is my sense of context, that I'm involved with various groups, and the people that I'm most immediately surrounded with, that's where I feel my context is. And so I'll tend to try and speak to that. But I try and push back to the extent that I can, without actually just disconnecting myself and ending up falling into another camp with the sort of kickback from the shots I'm firing in that direction, which is always a real danger. I think the other thing is the danger of my position is I'm between a lot of different communities, and it can be very easy to choose those things on the basis of personal convenience, the things that I want to choose to speak to. The other thing is thinking about the different locations that people are speaking from. I do not like the idea that we all have to be speaking to issues in the same way. We have different hills to die on. We have different forms of speech that we should be committed to. There are some people who are called to be Obadiahs in Ahab's court, to be people who are faithful to the Lord in very difficult situations where they cannot speak out if they're going to perform their task faithfully. There are also people who have to be out in the wilds of the wilderness as Elijah fleeing from Jezebel. Now, we need both of those, and Elijah and Obadiah can be on the same side, but they're not going to be speaking up for each other openly. And so for me, it's recognizing there are many people within my circles who will not necessarily be speaking out openly on some of the issues that I want to speak out openly upon, but yet they can be faithful in their situation. We're fighting the same fight. They may be deep operatives in a way that I'm not. But having those voices alongside each other, having trust between you, I think is hugely important. And recognizing that loyalty should not be loyalty just to the other people in your side or your camp. It's loyalty to the cause of the Lord. And that is something that may mean you feel isolated and abandoned by people when you find yourself in a bit of a scrape and they don't come out in your aid. But it's not really about you. It's about the Lord's cause.
Yeah, there's so much that I agree with there. I mean, this is maybe a, I mean, you asked me a pretty personal question, Andrew, so I'll just give you a personal answer. Some of it is a reaction against my own proclivities. So as someone who I think has a natural inclination to want to be liked, I feel like I do have to guard against that in certain respects. And I think that has probably animated me to take some unpopular stands that I think are true, but it's given me the kind of courage to take those stands that I think I might have lacked otherwise. Because I feel like I'm kind of overcoming some of my own proclivities there. So I think that is part of it. I mean, I do also think that there is a sense in which these issues, I do think, are of significant moral concern, moral and pastoral concern. I do tend to think that they are being under-treated by our community or being treated in ways that are objectionable to me. And so from my standpoint, like, I do feel an obligation just on the basis of no one else is saying this. And I think this thing needs to be said. Anytime, this is partly why, I mean, people mock me for how long my essays have been over the course of the years, but this is partly why my essays are so long, because I wait and I wait and I wait until someone else, like for someone else to say this thing. And I feel like no one does. And it just sort of wells up within me. And then I just feel like I have to say it. And to say it, I've got to say it in this particular way and with these sorts of nuances and with this kind of force. And that all of a sudden I'm at 8,000 words, right? I don't generate 12,000 words before breakfast the way Alistair seems to. Like, that's just not dispositionally how I am. And so for me, it really is a kind of, like, there is a gap here. I feel the gap, and I feel like I can helpfully address this gap. But I really wish someone else would do it. I really wish that someone with more standing, with more stature, someone who hasn't alienated the people that I've alienated, like who has more respect from influential folks than I have, I really wish someone else would do it. But this, the kind of sense of no one else is, I guess I've got to do this thing. That I feel that pretty significantly.
One thing about thinking about who speaks when, where, and how is, I mean, I think Andrew will agree with this. There are certain conversations that, you know, you have a responsibility to have in your congregation at the local context because they are expecting a word from you in season, out of season, about all of the word of God. That is your job. And so you have to be able to, you have to be ready to say something as best you can upon the base and authority of the word of God to a variety of issues that will come up. There's also the difference between then out there in the public world beyond your congregation, in sense of, so I'll put it this way. I used to shoot my mouth off a lot more when I thought I knew more than I did about a lot more issues, or I had an equal level of ignorance about a lot of issues. But as you start to specialize or recognize there's some things where I think I can continue to speak publicly about, but now I realize I actually probably should shut up on these three or four things, because I'm just going to be speaking at your average Joe level of unhelpfulness on that subject. Now I'll let somebody else go forward on that, even though if somebody in my congregation asks me about that, or my students ask me about that, I have an answer for them, those to whom I'm actually responsible for at that level. And so sometimes just knowing there are people that I will talk about everything with. There are people that I will talk about some things with, and how will you actually be able to be helpful? And so there's some people who you can't be equally helpfully across all sorts of subjects. And so just recognizing your limits, I think, is a significant consideration as well.
Yeah. I think that's a good word to end on. Derek, thanks for that. There's lots more that we could say about this, clearly. We hope this has been a helpful conversation for you in terms of thinking about how you might communicate in your own local communities and in the astonishing world that is social media and the internet, which is so full of fun and pitfalls everywhere. We'll be back. We're not actually going to do a plus one with Andrew. I was totally trolling him, but it is good to have him back. Andrew, we look forward to more conversations with you in the future. But we are again grateful to Lexham Press for sponsoring the show. If you do want to join the Merry Band of Patreon supporters, the link to do so in the show notes at Mirror Orthodoxy. Again, October 7th. Details forthcoming, but October 7th, we'll do a live Q&A, so join us for that. And we'll be back later this fall with other conversations about faith and how to navigate this particular world. So until then, this has been Mere Fidelity.